So this morning, what I'm going to start with is I've got two favorite quotes. The first one by Sayers, Attack of the Enemy Mutants. It's unwise to underestimate an adversary that's had a 3 billion evolutionary head start. And that's very smart because it means that these bugs are smart. And every time we think we've done something to get them, they come around and they do something and show us that we are wrong. So as we talk this morning, I'm going to show you some data regarding antimicrobial resistance. My bug of choice is E. coli, so we're going to focus on E. coli. We're going to talk a little bit about interpreting culture susceptibility testing. Normally, this is a three-hour session, and I spend a little bit more time on culture susceptibility testing, and I've had to cut some of that out. And then the last session after lunch, we'll overlap a little bit, but we'll focus on why culture and susceptibility testing is not good enough, even though it is a very powerful tool. So let's firstly look at whether or not resistance is a problem. It is a problem, at least as far as the world is concerned, and has been for a number of decades. In 1994, these news magazines started identifying the role of veterinary medicine in contributing to antimicrobial resistance. And what I've delineated here is the concern that veterinary medicine serves as a scapegoat, because what these articles focused on was the use of antibiotics in food animals for growth promotants. What they did not very much talk about is the other 90%, which probably came from human medicine, but the point to be taken here is if the veterinary profession doesn't take a judicious approach to antimicrobial use, then increasingly the human sector is going to look at us. And we will see that it's not, however, just a global responsibility on our part, but clearly it is a patient responsibility, and that's some of the data that we're going to see this morning. Bottom line is judicious antimicrobial use is paramount to our success in the use of antibiotics. We're going to talk about avoiding indiscriminate use, and if there's one thing that you walked out of here today committing yourself to, it's not using an antibiotic unless you're pretty convinced that you need to. And I'm going to share with you why. If you do that, I will be a happy camper. Once you've made the decision that you do need an antibiotic, my next goal is to ask you to consider using it appropriately, and that's what we'll spend the second session primarily focusing on. Why are we doing this? Well, clearly it's important for our patient, but there is a shifting focus in the human sector on veterinary medicine, and what they're doing now is they're beginning to shift from food animals to companion animals, and specifically dogs and cats, as far as are we using these antibiotics correctly. Why are they doing that? Well, there are many more pets out there in the world, and these many more pets have much closer relationships with our owners. Sometimes the relationship is too close, but it demonstrates the fact that there is potential for transmission. We take it one step further and we recognize MDUCA protects our right to use drugs in an extra label fashion, and we do that. Do we do it judiciously? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But increasingly, as we use these drugs of interest, the human sector is going to pay more and more attention to us. And there's increasing scientific evidence of transmission of pathogens between man and animals. Certainly we've known for a while Campylobacter and Salmonella, but increasingly methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. If an animal's got it, they probably got it from a person. If a person's got methicillin-resistant Staph intermedius, they probably got it from an animal. And as I shared with you my bug of choice, we're going to talk a little bit about E. coli, but there is increasing evidence that pathogens are being transmitted between dogs and their owners, or cats and their owners as well. And of course, it goes back and forth. So, steps to antimicrobial resistance, to antimicrobial therapy, so we can avoid resistance. Now, when I was in school, and I think still frequently the major determinant of what we select is, yep, we'll go to a broad spectrum drug, and then we'll pick one based on cost. And those are venues that have kind of worked well for us in the past, but in fact, they probably haven't. With convenience and safety and availability playing a lesser secondary role. Well, these are the new steps. The first most important question you ask yourself is, do I need to treat? And once you've answered that question, then the next question is, what is the target? What can I do to narrow the spectrum of my antimicrobial therapy so that I minimize the advent of resistance? Then the next most important question is, does the drug get to the site of infection at concentrations high enough to kill the bug? Dead bugs don't mutate. Session after lunch. And finally, how do we design the dosing regimen to assure that I get those effective concentrations? Now, these are actually, these are intended to tell you that I understand that successful antimicrobial therapy, and I'm going to define successful antimicrobial therapy not only as eradication of infection or resolution of infection, but avoiding resistance. And the two are not mutually acceptable. They do not go hand in hand. In fact, it's probably the exception rather than the rule that we get rid of infection while avoiding resistance. And what you're going to see here in a couple of minutes is why I think every time we use an antibiotic, we are indeed generating resistance, and it's the patient at risk that is getting in trouble. So these are the actual steps that I try and convince my students to go through as you're selecting an antibiotic, and I can show you an even nastier list as well. So the bottom line is, it is not going to be acceptable, at least in my mind, to use the approach that we've used for selecting antibiotics and the design of the dosing regimen in the past, because while it seemingly served us well, point in fact, I think it's gotten us in trouble. Why? Well, a second favorite quote from Dancer, he wrote on the problem with cephalosporins, even experienced practitioners may not realize that giving a patient an antibiotics affects not just that patient, but in fact their environment and therefore any other animal or person that comes in contact with that environment. Well, what's he talking about here? Well, what I do when I sit down with Rounds and the students and we start talking about antimicrobial therapy, I ask them to envision an animal that comes in with a urinary tract infection. We've been selecting antibiotics for urinary tract infections empirically for years, and we've been doing a good job at it. Or have we? So I'll ask them to identify what's the most likely pathogen, and they'll tell me E. coli, and everybody probably would agree, probably E. coli. And then I ask them to delineate the drugs that they would use to treat the E. coli, and they'll pick amoxicillin, amoxicillin clavulanic acid, cephalothin, a potentiated sulfonamide, and maybe if it's a problem, enrofloxacin or some other fluoroquinolone. All excellent choices, excreted in the urine, have efficacy. Then I'll ask them what percent of the time are they willing to be wrong with their choice of bug and drug. And they'll hem and they'll haw, and finally we'll compromise, and they'll get down to about 20%. They're willing to be wrong 10 to 20% of the time. I say, okay. So what I did when I first got to Auburn about 4 years ago, the criticalists were frustrated with a resistant E. coli that they thought was coming in with the surgical patients. The surgeons were frustrated with the same resistant E. coli that they thought the animals were picking up in critical care. So the first thing I set out to do is, well, do we really have a problem? So we did a retrospective study, and all we did is we had all dogs that came in with a urinary tract infection, whether it's first-time diagnosed, The criteria was the animal had to be admitted to Auburn, and it was the first time we had cultured that patient. So the animal could have been cultured and treated by another veterinarian. So any animal that came in within two-year period, if it had a urinary tract infection, we looked at the data. And we pulled out and looked at, firstly, the number, the percent of isolates that were that were E. coli. And the first thing I'm going to tell you is that only 50% of the isolates were, in fact, E. coli. The rest of the isolates that were causing infection in these 240 dogs were other gram-negatives or gram-positives, but the nice thing about them is, in general, those drugs that the students picked, those first-choice antibiotics, were antibiotics that should have been effective against those gram-negatives in the gram-positives as well. So if it was Proteus or Staph, most of those organisms would have been targeted by these same drugs. So that was okay, but the point to the students is we're still guessing wrong. 50% of the time we're guessing wrong if we think it's E. coli. How about our antibiotics? Well, this table here, this bar graph, this is the percent of isolates that are resistant to the antibiotics that are listed down here. And these are the antibiotics that we use in our standard antibiograms. So in this example, amikacin, none of the 240 E. coli isolates were resistant to amikacin. The problem is, when you look at our favorite drugs of choice, 40 to 50% of our isolates were resistant to those drugs. I was somewhat dumbfounded when I saw that. In fact, the only drugs that are consistently effective here are going to be our aminoglycosides, some of our third-generation cephalosporins, and nitrofurantoin, which, of course, is associated with peripheral neuropathies. So in my mind, we clearly had a problem. Now, was this an Auburn problem? I don't particularly know, although I'll show you some data here in just a couple minutes that implies maybe. But the bottom line is, from a clinical standpoint, choosing our favorite antibiotic, and this is what I tell the students, you're going to be wrong 50% of the time. Now, you may be arguing, well, you're a secondary tertiary care facility. These animals are coming into you already receiving antibiotics. And that's my point. If they're coming to us like this, why is that happening? We have to come back and ask what's happening at the level of the practitioner. Okay, so this is one of the things I'm going to strongly encourage each of you to do, and this is no small task, but what our microbiologist does for us now is every year she will take all the isolates that we have cultured from, in this case, dogs, and she will tell us the percent of those isolates that were susceptible to the drugs that are on our standard antibiogram. For example, this is amoxicillin clavulanic acid. The number in parentheses represents the number of those isolates that we cultured or isolated that year. The number on top of that number, 36 in this case, represents the number of isolates that are susceptible. So what can happen is if a student comes to me and says, oh, I think I've got an E. coli urinary tract infection, and I say, what do you want to treat it with? And they say amoxicillin clavulanic acid. I'll say, okay, you tell me what percent of those isolates in this practice will be susceptible to that drug. And so they'll come down here and they'll go, 314 isolates were cultured last year of E. coli in dogs. Of those, only 46% of them were susceptible to amoxicillin clavulanic acid. And so I'll ask them, do you really want to use amoxicillin clavulanic acid? And they'll go, no. Not, at least not empirically. So this data is, at least in my mind, very helpful if you are going to use antibiotics empirically. It will let you know what's going on in your practice area. Yes, sir. This susceptibility is based on culture susceptibility testing that we are doing. Yes, correct. The only way you can use this data is you can say, I have a patient that comes in with an E. coli infection in my patient. If I were to guess the likelihood that that E. coli is going to be susceptible to my drug, I'm going to probably guess 46% of the time wrong. Okay. What you can't say is, I can't guarantee you that every organ, all you can say is that if I have an E. coli in an infection, cause an infection in my patient, I've probably got a 46% chance or less than 50% chance of susceptibility. Okay. Does that make sense? Now, what we haven't pulled out here is, is this a first-time infection? Is it a simple, uncomplicated infection? This includes the whole pool, so as long as you recognize that, would your chances be better if this is a first-time, simple, and complicated infection? Absolutely. But the problem is, doing that is what's causing this. And so it's a bit of a catch-22. Okay. And then the same thing for ampicillin. And ampicillin, I kind of tell people, you know, we use it in our critical care in patients because we give it intravenously. I'm going to tell you, it's a terrible drug. When you look at the percent of isolates that are susceptible, as long as it's an Enterococcus faecalis, we've got 99% susceptible. We drop down here, Proteus, 85% of them are susceptible. And then most of our Streptococcus are susceptible. The rest of them, the numbers are 0, 10, 20, 39%. Ampicillin does not have much of a spectrum anymore. If it's a drug that you're using in the critical care patient, I guess I'm going to query why, because that's the very patient that needs to make sure it has an antibiotic on board that's going to work. Okay, so I'm just going to encourage you to back up and start looking at what's happening in your practice area as we continue to use antibiotics empirically. And let me go forward. So why is this happening? Well, I ask the students where the E. coli comes from, and they'll tell me the gastrointestinal tract, and that's probably true. I think there's enough data out there to suggest that at least for urinary tract infections, the organism is coming from the gastrointestinal tract. So I'll ask them, well, why aren't you developing an infection? Why isn't this E. coli that's in your GI tract going crazy? And then I'll ask them to tell me the organisms that are in the GI tract. So they'll mention E. coli, and then Proteus, and a couple of other coliforms. And then finally, somebody will remember that there's anaerobes down there. And so I'll say, okay, how many anaerobes are down there compared to gram-negatives? And they'll hem and they'll haw, and then they'll be surprised when I remind them it's like 99 anaerobes to one gram-negative coliform. So why is that? I mean, there's not few things that are happened by chance unless there's a specific call for that in the body. And the answer is because those anaerobes are the guys that keep the gram-negative coliforms in check, and they do it two ways. They do it, firstly, by simple competition. They use up the nutrients, so the gram-negative coliforms don't have as much access to the nutrients, and they can't thrive as well. But the other thing that the anaerobes do that we forget about is they secrete antibiotics, and they constantly secrete antibiotics to keep the other microbes in check. Well, when they secrete antibiotics, to make sure that they don't die, they also develop genes for resistance to those very same antibiotics. Now, when they do die, those genes are floating around, and those genes can be picked up by other organisms. So you come along now with a broad-spectrum antibiotic that targets the anaerobes. You get rid of the competition. The gram-negatives are already used to trying to develop mechanisms of resistance because they're constantly being exposed to antibiotics. And what you do is you promote the generation of a population of resistant microbes. Does this really happen? Well, I think the data out there supports that it happens with our broad-spectrum antibiotics, such as amoxicillin. If you go to the human sector, they've done a lot of work trying to couple previous antimicrobial therapy with the advent of resistance, and they've done it largely historically. And what I've done here is taken off the website a timeline to antimicrobial resistance. Each of these drug classes begins with an arrow here, and that's when the drug was approved, and then it ends at the arrow. The arrow ends at the point that resistance develops. And you can look at this, and this is, each bar here is 10 years. You can see without even looking very hard that the advent of resistance usually takes about a decade or less. Here is norfloxacin. This is the fluorinated quinolone, the first fluorinated quinolone approved for use. Within 3 years, we had antimicrobial resistance to the fluorinated quinolones. If you look at the advent of methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or now Staph intermedius, you can almost marry it exactly to the advent of cephalosporins. And every time we've come up with a new cephalosporin, Staph has figured a way to become resistant to it. Methicillin-resistant Staph intermedius, we're now beginning increasingly to see isolated reports in animals. We've probably had three of them in our at Auburn in the last month. So it is increasingly becoming a problem, and most of them are derm cases. Fluorinated quinolones, the very drugs whose promotion was based upon the lack of plasmid-mediated resistance. Oh, you won't get resistance with these drugs. I don't think so. Within 3 years, and now increasingly, we're seeing resistance by Pseudomonas, Staph, and E. coli. So, from a clinical standpoint, as we think about using drugs in these patients, what I'm talking about here is, I think a standard scenario is, we have an infection, it's caused by a wimp bug. The wimp bug is Pasteurella. Pasteurella is easy to get by just about anything. So we treat, but we kind of use the lower dose or a broad spectrum antibiotic. The next, and most patients, that's fine, but then when our infection comes back the next time, well, we've gotten rid of all the Pasteurella. The guy that's there now is Bordetella. All right, so we treat again, a little bit more aggressive with our therapy. We wipe the Bordetella out. Some patients will do okay, but the next time we see that infection, because we've gotten rid of the Pasteurella and the Bordetella, guess who's there now? Pseudomonas. And we see this in the ear, we see this in the nose, we see it in the urinary tract. Although the urinary tract, we don't have to worry about Pseudomonas because we make E. coli resistance. So I think that we see this. This is why we see that constant progression of resistance in our patients. All right. So an example here is the cephalosporins. Coming back to these guys, just to show you how smart these bugs are, every time we've come up with a new set of cephalosporins, we call it a new generation. So the second generation cephalosporins, yes, it's a chronological significance, but mainly those second generation cephalosporins were more resistant to beta-lactamase destruction than were the first. Third generation, even more resistance, and now we've got 4, 5, 6, 7 groups of cephalosporins, each group being more able to offset beta-lactamase resistance. At least so we thought. What has happened now, and this is a world map, Klebsiella, E. coli, and others, they are now able to make what are called extended spectrum beta-lactamases. They are induced. The organism sees the drug coming, it goes, oh my gosh, and it starts making more of these beta-lactamases. Because they're induced, they're hard to pick up on culture and susceptibility testing unless your lab specifically looks for those. They have to do a specific test for that, and our lab does. And you can see that the proportion of isolates produced in ESBLs is very low in the United States, but that was 10 years ago, and that's a much different picture now. This is one of the reasons that I'm very careful using a third-generation cephalosporin based on culture data unless my lab has looked specifically for ESBLs. So I avoid third-generation cephalosporins unless I know I can use them. And unfortunately, one of the drugs that is actually used to detect these extended spectrum beta-lactamases is cefpodoxime, which is a great drug, and we'll see it again a little bit later, but is very susceptible to these extended spectrum beta-lactamases, and you need to be careful. One of the nice things that you can do is use either imipenem or meropenem or amoxicillin clavulanic acid. It is not susceptible to these ESBLs, and it's one of the reasons to keep that drug on your shelf. So if I'm going to stand up here and tell you that every time you use a broad-spectrum antimicrobial, you are going to increase the portion of E. coli that are resistant in the gastrointestinal tract, I thought what I'd try and do is prove that to you and show you what happens when you give normal drugs at normal doses to normal dogs. So our hypothesis here was that the routine use of either amoxicillin or enrofloxacin at standard doses would result in resistance. For amoxicillin, we thought it would probably be plasmid-mediated, which means it would happen rapidly and it would go away once the drug went away. That's microbes get rid of those plasmids if they don't need them anymore. For the fluorinated quinolones, we thought it would take a little bit longer, but once it emerged, it probably stayed there because that's a mutation. And once the mutation occurs, all the daughter cells have that mutation. They can't get rid of it. So we took normal dogs. We actually took our hound dogs, and we gave them amoxicillin 10 mg per kg every 12 hours, and we looked at fecal E. coli. And the question we ask is, what percent of the fecal E. coli are now resistant to that drug? So this is baseline. The crossed bars are the percent of E. coli's that are now resistant. At baseline, about 20% as we started out, but within 3 days, 100% of the E. coli's were resistant to amoxicillin in the gastrointestinal tract of these normal dogs. Now, we stopped the drug on day 7, and by the time day 21 rolled around, we weren't quite back to baseline, but we were there. Point. Well, first of all, you're causing resistance, but secondly, if an animal's been on amoxicillin, clavulanic acid within the last 3 weeks, I culture before I empirically chose a drug. Let's take this one step further. Here's Enreflux, and we gave it at 5 mg per kg once a day. Same sort of thing, less resistance starting out, but it did happen almost as rapidly. Within 5 days, 100% of our isolates were resistant, but look what happened here. We stopped the drug on day 7. We did not see resolution. And we did not go any further than day 21 because it didn't have the funds to do it. But the point is that emrefloxacin, 100% of isolates became resistant to emrefloxacin, and it was still there when we stopped at 3 weeks. Well, unfortunately, that's not the only story. And this is the control data. You can see a little bit of intermittent resistance, but otherwise not there. But here's the problem, the additional problem. This resistance is high level. What do I mean by that? Well, we're going to talk about the breakpoint MIC here in just a couple minutes. The breakpoint MIC is the level of the threshold of susceptibility. It's the MIC below which your lab will tell you your isolate's susceptible. Above it, your isolate is resistant. For amoxicillin, the breakpoint is 32. So any isolate that you got that had an MIC less than 32 would be considered susceptible. Well, unfortunately, these resistant bugs had MICs of greater than 256. Well, when we compare that to 32, that's a very, very, very high level of resistance. So they not only developed resistance, but very high level of resistance. The nice thing about this, however, is it was resistance only to amoxicillin. Not so with Enro. Again, very high level of resistance. The threshold of susceptibility for Enro is 4 micrograms per mil. These guys had more than 64 micrograms per mil. That means it took that much drug, 64 micrograms per mil, to inhibit them. But here's what I want you to see. These organisms were multi-drug resistant. They weren't resistant just to Enro. They were resistant to essentially every drug class except the aminoglycosides. What's that mean to me? Well, here's what I worry about. I worry every time we use enrofloxacin, we're causing our GI tract isolates to become resistant, and they're developing multi-drug resistance. And in the normal animal, where you've gotten rid of the infection, there's no immune suppression, there's no cancer chemotherapy, it's not a geriatric animal, it's no problem. Just recognize that those resistant bugs are in your patient, and I don't know how long that they stick around there. But I also think this is probably happening at the site of infection. I'm probably going to need to wait and get questions afterwards. Is that okay? Just because I'm afraid I've got a lot of ground to cover, and I may answer your question here. But please do ask your question at the end of the session. So I'm afraid that this is also what's happening in other areas of the body, too, not just the gastrointestinal tract. We took it one step further, coming back to ask the question, is this just an Auburn problem? Because, you know, that's experimental. What's actually happening in the clinical patient, I'm not really sure. So what we did this time is we did a prospective study where we got 450 E. coli isolates from around the United States, and we worked with commercial laboratories and academic laboratories. And these stars just indicate where we got the different isolates. And then we did what is called an E-test, and I'm going to talk about the E-test in the second hour because the E-test is a much more powerful tool for you as a clinician, and increasingly it's being used in human medicine as a basis for susceptibility testing. But the bottom line is it allows us to test a much wider range of concentrations. So what you see here is we had 401 isolates. Of those 401 isolates, what we've done here is we've said the percent of those isolates that are resistant to each of the drugs. This is amoxicillin, clavulanic acid, cefpodoxime, doxycycline, enrofloxacin, gentamicin, trimethoprim sulfa. And we were interested in regional differences because, remember, I told you Auburn seemed to have a problem. So we have the west in the dark purple, the north part of the United States in the light purple. mid-central United States in blue and the South in the light blue. And you can see across the board, yep, we got problems in the South, and I'm not sure what it is. I don't know if it's antimicrobial prescribing behaviors, but in the South, resistance is higher for every one of these drugs. The rest of the sites, or rest of the regions in the United States still have a problem. Throughout the United States, about 40% of isolates are resistant to amoxicillin, amoxicillin clavulanic acid, a little bit better. Even cefpodoxime, how long has it been out there? You know, 4 years? 20% of our isolates are resistant to that drug now. And on down the list, trimethoprim sulfa, I think one of the reasons that it is doing the best is, like gentamicin, we've stopped using it as much because of the concern of adverse events to sulfonamides. Same thing with doxycycline. It's doing a little bit better because about 10 years ago we stopped using it because of resistance. Not totally, but we limited it. So this data suggests to me that there are regional differences, but mainly it suggests to me we have a problem with E. coli. And if you take this one step further, what we did is, these are the phenotypes, and it's a very busy chart, but I think I can explain what this is saying. We took all those isolates that were resistant, and we just wrote out a phenotype. And that means that if that particular isolate was resistant to amoxicillin, it got an A. If that particular isolate was resistant to amoxicillin and amoxicillin clavulanic acid, it got an AX. So if you look down here, for example, this isolate with AXPDEG, well, it was multi-drug resistant. It was resistant to just about everything. And so we had three isolates that were resistant to all these things. So what's the point of this? Well, if you look at isolates that are resistant to only amoxicillin or amoxicillin clavulanic acid, in other words, resistant to beta-lactams, we had about 35 of those isolates that were resistant only to those drugs. If you look at the number of isolates that are only resistant to enrofloxacin, 2. In fact, what we found is that if an isolate was resistant to enrofloxacin, it was resistant to almost everything. So my concern, again, is that as we are using the fluorinated quinolones, and if we are generating resistance, we are seeing multi-drug resistance, which is going to be hard to overcome in our patient. What does this mean to you as a clinician? Well, I think the biggest thing, and we've done a pretty good job, I think, in backing off using the fluorinated quinolone, but I want you to be aware of this, and then the most important thing is to use the fluorinated quinolone correctly, which is what we'll talk about in the second session. So, as we look at the steps to antimicrobial therapy, hopefully what I've done is somewhat convinced you that there clearly is a problem out here. It's not in all of our patients, at least it doesn't emerge in all of our patients. Antimicrobial therapy is not innocuous. In the standard patient, it won't come back to bite you, but in the problematic patient, it's going to come back and bite you if we don't use these antibiotics appropriately. And so because of that, in my mind, the single most important question you need to ask yourself as you reach for an antibiotic is, do I really need this antibiotic? And for too long, I think in both human medicine and in veterinary medicine, we have used antibiotics because we don't know what else to do. This is just a brochure that's in physicians' office now telling people that just because you got a cold doesn't mean you need an antibiotic. Antibiotics don't work in that scenario. And I think that we need to kind of take the same approach ourselves. Our clients expect something. An antibiotic in the past has been something that we could easily give. They're not toxic. And that's gotten us in trouble. So my job is to not convince you, or is to not discuss what you need to look at to convince yourself that you do need to treat. I've just listed things here, and the only thing that I'm going to remind you of these things here, the only thing that will specifically tell you that you do have an infection is phagocytized organisms, because if the white cells are picking those bugs up, they ain't supposed to be there. And if you have access to them, serum titers or other molecular techniques that looks for specific pathogens. Even culture and susceptibility testing does not confirm infection, because far too many of our isolates are normal commensal organisms, and culture data may not help you discriminate between infection versus a commensal, the presence of the bug. And we'll talk about that a little bit more here, how you might use the data, the culture susceptibility testing, to tell you if there is infection. But the point is, just ask yourself, do I need to treat? And if you don't, then don't. Now, as we look at empirical use of antibiotics, as we go to the next step of antibiotic selection, what is the target? Then the next thing I'm going to remind you of is, although we've said historically simple, uncomplicated infections, it's okay to use an antibiotic empirically, I'm just going to tell you increasingly, I don't know if that's okay anymore. Because I think when you look at the data, the historical data, that tells you, I've got an infection here, it's probably caused by this particular organism, that data is 20 years old, 30 years old. And that data did not make an attempt to discriminate between pathogens and normal commensal organisms. So I don't think that we can do a real good job in guessing what infections we're treating with. There are some exceptions, and one of them might be the urinary tract and E. coli, but I already warned you that we're wrong 50% of the time there. Certainly staph pyoderma would be an example of when we generally think we can predict infection, and maybe abscesses, you know, if it's a cat, pastorella, or anaerobes. But the point that I'm going to make is increasingly we are guessing wrong. In these three scenarios, if you do make the decision to use an antibiotic empirically, I'm just going to ask you to use it correctly. And what we're talking about are higher doses and shorter intervals. And again, that will be our after-lunch discussion. The other time that you're going to use antibiotics empirically is if you're dealing with a life-threatening infection where you can't wait to get your culture results. And that's fine. But you need to get your culture first and then be prepared to change it. But here's my warning to you. In any of these scenarios, you've cultured first, and then you guess your antibiotic, and you use that antibiotic, and you get your culture data back, and you guessed wrong. That microbe population has changed. It is not the same microbe, and you can't use that susceptibility data anymore to guess what you need to use, because it's not the same population. Because you've used the antibiotic, you've changed the population, and you really need to reculture again. So just stand warned about that. The most ideal thing would be to culture, and if you can, wait. And I know that you can't do that, but I just want you to be aware, you use the drug, you're going to change the bug. And that's going to make your job a little bit more difficult. Okay, so as we move into culture susceptibility testing, and I won't be able to spend a lot of time talking about it, having said that it can't help you all the time, I do want to point out that it is important. For example, Elizabeth Hardy demonstrated that it led to a change in antibiotic care in 45% of her critical patients, and this was about 20 years ago. My husband is a soft tissue surgeon, and I did a retrospective study with pyothorax patients, and we found that we guessed 35% of the time incorrectly with pyothorax. That's primarily because we tended to use ampicillin. So this can be a powerful tool for selecting an antibiotic. However, just a couple of points about the organism that you've grown itself. Is it representative growth of what's causing infection in your patient? Look for purity. If you see this kind of thing where you've got three or more organisms, I try and reculture again because chances are this is a contamination. Now, one of the things our lab does is it will tell you if we've got light growth or heavy growth or moderate growth. If I've got a light growth bug, I'm going to ignore that. I'll focus on the heavy growth bug because I'm hopeful if I get rid of the heavy growth, that'll get rid of the light growth. The other thing that I'll do is if we've got colony forming counts, remember in the urinary tract, you don't even have an infection unless you've got 10 to the 5 colony forming units. If I've got less than 10 to the 5 colony forming units, as exemplified here by this E. coli, I'm not going to treat unless there's a good reason for doing that. Maybe it's a cancer patient that has chemotherapy on board. Maybe it's an animal that has pyelonephritis, and I think that what's in the bladder is also what's in the kidney. Maybe then I'll treat. But otherwise, I won't. I'll send the client home unless the animal has clinical signs. And let me back up. Of course, if the animal has clinical signs, you'll need to treat. But if not, or if I'm not sure that those clinical signs are referred to the urinary tract, I'll send him home and I'll ask him to come back and reculture in 2 weeks to make sure that I've got an infection. Also, look at your data. This is a lactobacillus. Can anybody tell me what a lactobacillus is doing in the bladder? I'm guessing that these isolates were actually picked up from the gastrointestinal tract as the cysto was done. So if I see something that looks a little bit unusual, I'll either call the lab or I'll reculture. That would be the smarter thing to do. If you've got an isolate that does have light growth, you know, call the lab up. Did they have to coax this isolate out? Did they have to use special media? And if so, then maybe it's not really the thing that's causing the problem in your patient. And again, rethink whether or not you need to treat. This is just another example. I've got two isolates here that I would not treat because I've got such a small number of organisms. And then finally, looking at the other end of the spectrum, remember that there are some things that are difficult to find on culture, the anaerobes, mycoplasma. So always look at your site of infection and ask yourself, is it possible that I've got an anaerobic organism on board, or is it possible that mycoplasma is contributing to this infection? And because of those two groups of organisms, you may want to select your antibiotics to protect yourself against those guys. I'm going to try and spend a little bit more time, and we don't have a bunch of time left for this first session, but I want to go into how you can use tube dilution data to help you select not only a drug, but also a dose. This is a standard culture susceptibility report. This came from a dog that had Proteus that was in the right tympanic bulla, and this animal had had a Tika. And so these are the kind of things that we're faced with. And what I want to do is show you how you can use these numbers to actually help you discriminate among the different S's that are on here. Remember, with tube dilution, in contrast to the AgriGel diffusion, tube dilution is accomplished in this way. Various test tubes contain increasing concentrations of the drug of interest. The inoculum is grown to a standard amount. It is used to inoculate these test tubes. After a specified period of time, the test tubes are observed for no visible sign of growth, and that test tube that has the lowest concentration of drug and no visible sign of growth is the test tube that contains the minimum inhibitory concentration. And that is the number that you see on your culture report, the MIC. Okay. You can get this, and we're going to talk just a little bit about getting this from your patient, and we're going to talk a little bit about population data. If you got this from your patient, in this scenario, this might have been an ear. We got two isolates out of the ear, so those are the organisms infecting the patient. These are our drugs of interest. This is the SIRR interpretation that you will get from the lab. You would also get, this is all you would get with AgriGel diffusion. But with tube dilution data, you not only get the SIRR, but you also get the MIC of the infecting organism. And this gives you a mechanism to start discriminating among the drugs. Now, I can also look at population data. And the reason that we're going to spend a little bit of time looking at that is because you get it off of package inserts. And you can use population MIC data to help you not only select drugs, but to design doses. For example, if I was interested in what it took in general to get amoxicillin clavulanic acid and staph intermedius, so in general, for a population of staph intermedius, how much amoxicillin clavulanic acid would it take? I could take 100 dogs, get 100 different staph intermediuses, culture them all, get their MICs, plot those MICs. I would have an MIC range, which was quite broad here, 0.125 to 64. Doesn't help me predict what my particular patient is going to have. Doesn't help me decide what drug concentration to target. But what I can do is I can say, okay, I'll pick the 50th percentile. Because what that tells me is I've got a 50% chance that my patient's MIC for staph intermedius and amoxicillin clavulanic acid is 2 micrograms per mil or less. Well, that's fine, except I've got a 50% chance of being wrong, so I don't like that. So what I like is the MIC-90. And what this would tell me in this made-up scenario is that I would have a 90% chance that my staph intermedius in my patient would be inhibited with amoxicillin clavulanic acid at a concentration of 16 micrograms per mil or less. For example, this is difloxacin. We look at the package insert data. And we look at, here's an MIC range for a variety of organisms. We have an MIC 90, we have an MIC 50, and then they have provided for us the number of isolates that have been used to generate that sample population. Now, just a word of warning, you want to make sure that your sample population is large enough. But what we now have is a number here, this MIC 90. And what I can do is I can compare that MIC 90, which is an indicator of what I need to get my particular organism, and compare it to what I'm going to get. What am I going to get? Well, what I'm going to get is the maximum drug concentration at the recommended dose. So what I can do now is I can look at E. coli with an MIC 90 of 0.11, or Proteus with an MIC 90 of 1.83 and compare it to the Cmax. And what I find out when I do that is the ratio of what I'm going to get, 1.8, to what I need for E. coli is 16. That ratio for Proteus is 1. Now, when I look at this data, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to think twice before I use difloxacin to treat Proteus. But I'm not going to hesitate to use it to treat E. coli. So what we're doing here is we're using package insert data to look at how much drug we need to get a population of organisms and to see how much drug we're going to get when I give the drug at the recommended dose to make decisions about, A, do I want to use this drug, but B, am I going to use the drug at the low dose or the high dose? This 1.8 microgram per mil is at 5 mg per kg of difloxacin. This ratio of 16, that's pretty darn high. So I'm willing to use the low dose. If I'm going to use this drug to treat Proteus, which I'm probably not going to do, but if I do, I'm certainly going to use it at the high dose. So we've used the package insert data to help us discriminate among drugs. We can do the same thing with marbofloxacin. For marbofloxacin, here's our MIC90 for E. coli and Proteus. When we look at the package insert and we look at the dose of 2.5 mg per kg, we compare 2 to 0.06 or 2 to 1.25, and you can see the ratios are great, 25, and now it's 12. Marbofloxacin is a much better drug to treat Proteus than is difloxacin. How about for Pseudomonas? Well, for Pseudomonas, they didn't have enough isolates to give me an MIC90, so I've got a range here. If I am conservative and use the highest concentration of any of the pseudomonads on this package insert, it's 1. When I compare my Cmax of 2 to my MIC of 1, my ratio is only 2. I'm not real comfortable with that, so I'm thinking I'm probably going to use the higher dose, which gives me a higher plasma drug concentration, which gives me a higher ratio. Now, when we come back after lunch, you're going to see that's not good enough. But at least on paper, marbofloxacin is a much better choice for, compared to difloxacin. And we'll take this last bit to show you how you can do this in the individual patient. In the individual patient, when you get your report back and you have an MIC of 4 micrograms per mil for amoxicillin clavulanic acid, well, presumably, that's what you want to get in the tissues. You'd want to get the MIC of your infecting organism. Well, do you get there? Well, the problem is, how do you know? We don't have information necessarily about the maximum drug concentration on the package insert. Well, you can go to the literature. For example, this comes out of my textbook, and I've gone through and I've gotten all the maximum drug concentrations for all the antibiotics we use in dogs and cats. And so I would look at this and I go, okay, at 11 mg per kg, I'm going to get 6 micrograms per mil of amoxicillin in dogs. And now I can start comparing that to the MIC that I get from my patient. And we'll do this in the second hour. Or the other thing that I can do is I can use the breakpoint MIC. The breakpoint MIC is what the lab uses to decide whether or not your isolate is susceptible or resistant. Now, this breakpoint MIC is largely based upon plasma drug concentrations. This is a nationally shared number. This is generated by clinical laboratory institute standards. They set standards for labs. They are the same numbers throughout the United States, and they are the same numbers for all organisms. Your labs don't put it on your report, but both Antech and IDEX tell me you can get it off of their website, or hopefully you can get it from your notes. But what it does is it allows us to standardize, if you will, these numbers by looking at how much we need and comparing it to how much we're going to get. 4 for cephalothin looks like it's not as good as 2 for amoxicillin clavulanic acid. This is staph intermediates. Well, let's compare these numbers to the breakpoint MIC over here. Since this is staph intermediates and this is amoxicillin clavulanic acid, we're going to use the 8. If it were anything besides staph and amoxicillin clavulanic acid, we could use 32. But staph produces beta-lactamases, and because of that, we have to use this lower number, and that's what the labs will use. So we'll compare 2 to 8 and 4 to 32. And when we do that, you will see that cephalexin looks much better. Cephalexin and cephalothin are model drugs. So in this scenario, I would be inclined to use cephalothin because I've got a much better ratio of what I need to what I'm going to get. We can do the same thing with enrofloxacin and amikacin. Here's what I'm going to need, 0.125. Amikacin less than 2. What this means is the lab didn't test any lower than 2, so the lowest number it would be is 1. And the only reason I know that is because these are serial dilutions, so they're always two-fold dilutions. So for amikacin and staph, it could be as little as 1. It might be lower, but we don't know that. So we'll calculate our ratios assuming that this is 1, and what you see is our ratios for amikacin is going to be 32, actually would be greater than 32 or 64 or more. For enrofloxacin, the ratio is only 16. So even though enro is a smaller number, all things being equal on culture and susceptibility testing, amikacin would be the better choice. If we went and did the same sort of thing with this Proteus that we got out of the ear of the dog, I'm going to get rid of everything except the S's. Now I'm going to put the breakpoint MICs are right here. I calculated my inhibitory quotients, and what you see is the best drugs would be either amikacin, enrofloxacin, or potentially a potentiated sulfonamide. Okay. All right, and that actually is all I'm going to do on the first session. Now, there was a question in the back that I kind of asked you to talk. I can't hear you. I'm sorry. Was it consistent? That's a really good question, and I just published in JVIN a study that looked at comparing the fluorinated quinolones as far as efficacy using a number of model isolates, and these were all isolates that I collected from dogs and cats throughout the United States. And what I found in general is if a fluorinated quinolone, an isolate is resistant to one fluorinated quinolone, it's going to be resistant to all of them. Okay. And I think that is true. However, what we'll see in the next session is it's the level of susceptibility that varies among the drugs. If I have an isolate that is susceptible to a fluorinated quinolone, it's going to be more susceptible in general to enro, marbofloxacin, or cipro. In general, they're more resistant to orbifloxacin and difloxacin, which means that those drugs, resistance is going to develop more rapidly too. Does that make sense? Okay. Yes, sir. The question is, do I culture while the patient is on antibiotics? And the answer is, it depends upon what I'm after, but absolutely. And the good example is a urinary tract infection. If you have a problematic urinary tract infection, I would encourage you, start your antibiotic that you think is going to work, use it at the dose and the interval that you think is appropriate, culture the animal after about 3 to 5 days on the antibiotic. A no growth means piddly squat, but clearly growth means that you've got a problem. When you're ready to stay, so you either change the drug at that point, or if you've got no growth and you continue treating the animal, if you treat for a long time, 4 to 6 weeks, I would reculture just before I stop the antibiotic, make sure I'm still clear of growth, and then once I've stopped the antibiotic, about a week afterwards, I culture again to see if I've got reinfection or persistent infection. Okay. And that's easy for the urinary tract because it's something that we can access. Okay. Other questions? Okay, this was hard to digest, but what we'll do is when we come back after lunch, we're going to talk about why targeting the MIC, like I did here, is not good enough, and what we need to do with our dosing regimens to assure or minimize the advent of resistance. Enjoy your lunch. Thank you very much.